Kia ora, welcome to Emirates Podcast, episode 301. Today is Friday, August 30, 2013. I'm back, again. Well, it's been busy for me. I'm actually almost always busy, I think, these days. And there's been so much going on, so many different things, and we've had a lot of interrupted schedules and unexpected long weekends and things that have made it virtually impossible for me to get around to recording, primarily because I still cannot get past this block I have about recording when somebody else is in the house. And that's affected things several times, actually. This particular episode, this is the third go at recording this episode. I suppose I've done one a month. It hasn't been that long. But I've done several of them. Let's see, I'm just looking back. I did one in July, and I did one in June, one in July, and one today. So that's over 3 months it's taken me to do this. But I was thinking, while relatively recently, that when I talked before about not being sure if I was going to continue and all that stuff, that I said that I might stop at episode 300. And I thought, geez, what if somebody takes me seriously about that? Because I didn't literally mean I was going to stop at 300. But I didn't, clearly. Although there were moments there where I thought, well, why even bother resuming? And then I was on Twitter last night, and two of my pals, I'm just going to call up their Twitter names so that I can get that right, at Seawall and at, I don't actually know how to pronounce it, if it's test pattern or what, but it's T-E-S-T-P-A, single T-E-R-N, both American expats in New Zealand, so you can follow them if you wish. But they both reminded me that my return to podcasting was well and truly overdue. I'm going to tell you about some of the things that I've been up to over the past couple of months since I last recorded. And it's been, as I said, there's been quite a lot. But before that, there's things going on in New Zealand that I wanted to talk about that in some ways, well, not in some ways, in every way, are much bigger and more important. First and foremost, what I've been talking about, lo, these many months, is that the marriage equality bill took effect on Monday, August 19th, and there were many weddings held that day across the country, including the Australian couple that I talked about who won the contest. And I blogged about the day and also about my reaction to it. I'll put links to both of those posts in the show notes to this episode, which you can find at amrinspodcast.com. But basically, it went really well. There was almost nothing to sully the day. There weren't protests, certainly. There weren't protests. There wasn't a lot of media whinging. My old buddy, Bob McCroskey, was pretty much behaving himself. Two of the conservative broadcast outlets, News Talk ZB, which is a more or less conservative news talk, what do you call it in the U.S.? We call it talk back here, talk radio sort of station. And in their online stories, they were quoting Bob. I don't know if they had him on air at all. And TVNZ was quoting Colin, God bless, Craig. I suppose I should explain sometime why I call him that. I call him that because he used to sign his campaign letters, God bless. And it just seemed so phony that it became sort of a joke. So now we call him Colin, God bless, Craig. Anyway, he has this party that he bankrolls called the Conservative Party, I call it the Colin Craig Party, because as far as I know, there aren't any real people who support it apart from him and a few hangers on. Anyway, TVNZ quoted him in the web coverage and also on their evening news, saying it's a sad day for New Zealand. And which I thought was a really tacky thing for them to do, because it wasn't the day to talk politics. Nobody was talking politics. They were just sharing the joy of the couples who were getting married that day. And I thought that it was really tacky to quote him, to allow him to talk about that. I mean, if they wanted to do a separate story about all the hand-wringing among the fundamentalist Christians, well, you know, by all means, go do that. But they shouldn't have sullied the report about the happiness of these couples with this creep talking about how it's a sad, and he is a creep, by the way. He's, among other things, he's he said that homosexuality is a choice and that he could choose to be gay. And of course, that opened him up to immediate ridicule by everybody all over the spectrum. But I digress. So that was a very big day. It was a very good day. And those two little incidents didn't mar the day. It just kind of pointed out how kind of icky Newstalk ZB is and how out of touch TVNZ can be as well. But more bigger news was just this past Thursday when the leader of the opposition, the leader of the Labour Party, David Shearer, unexpectedly resigned and caught most of us off guard. I don't know if he caught everybody. And it has set off this frenzy ever since. There are three candidates for the leadership of the Labour Party. One is the MP for New Lynn here in Auckland called David Cunliffe, who was one of the candidates last time when David Shearer actually won. And he also was implicated in a potential coup about a year ago. And he was demoted and put on the back benches. He's articulate. He is sort of a policy wonk. He was a successful cabinet minister in the last Labour government. And he is reputedly the darling of the left wing of the Labour Party. And about as many people who like him loathe him, apparently. He comes across very often as arrogant or at least smug and a bit of a know-it-all sometimes and not very genuine, not genuinely warm. So I don't know. Actually the first candidate to announce was Grant Robertson, who's the deputy leader of the Labour Party currently. He's also openly gay and the MP for Wellington Central. And ever since he announced, the media has been going to overdrive asking, is New Zealand ready for a gay prime minister? And I think this is not an entirely healthy thing that the media has been doing. Asking the question at first, you know, fresh out of the gate or whatever, might be acceptable because it might be a legitimate question. But to keep revisiting it again and again and again, it sort of creates the impression in some people's minds that maybe they ought to be opposed to him, or maybe they ought to have a concern about a gay prime minister, rather than the reaction of most Kiwis, which is like, who cares? It's veered into the territory of the news media making the news rather than reporting it, and that's been very unfortunate. The third candidate is a guy named Shane Jones, who's a List MP. He's Māori. He was once touted as a future, not necessarily leader, but certainly a powerful person within the party. But then he sort of ruined it all. When he was minister, he used his ministerial charge card to order porn at a hotel he was staying at and also to use the minibar. Now, somebody who I follow on Twitter says that he took the fall for somebody else who actually rented the porn. And I would like to see evidence of that, to be honest. That doesn't make him noble, in my view. It makes him stupid, because he's the one who was banished to the Netherlands after that. Not Netherlands, Netherworld after that, because he... he was disgraced, basically, for using taxpayer money for porn and the minibar. And he's been pretty much on the outer ever since. And he was also accused of other various things over the years. He is sexist. He's homophobic. He's from the right wing of the Labour Party, definitely the right wing. I don't particularly care for him, to be honest. Because he's sexist and homophobic, he very recently, just this past week, a week ago or so, no, a bit longer than that, I guess, he was quoted as saying that that people didn't want geldings running the country, meaning women, apparently, and which is a bit rich because he was brought in by Helen Clark when she was prime minister. So I thought that was just weird. But he's pompous. He talks in flowery language, which some people seem to just adore, not in the sense of, you know, thinking he's being eloquent or something, but just I think because so many people don't like him talking like that, they feel it's he's sticking it to them, I guess. I'm maybe reading into that, but I don't understand why people think that his way of speaking is a good thing, because he alienates more people than he wins over. So, but what I did find interesting about this is that at the same time the media was asking, is New Zealand ready for a gay prime minister? Not one of them, not one of them asked, is New Zealand ready for a Māori prime minister? So I suppose that's a sort of progress that they're no longer asking that question, because neither of the two main parties, Labour and National, has ever had a leader who is Māori. So there's never been a Māori MP, prime minister or leader of the opposition. And if Jones were to become leader of the Labour Party, which is highly improbable, then he would be the first leader of the opposition who is Māori and potentially the first prime minister. And but nobody's asking about that. And I actually take that as, like I said, a sign of some sort of progress, even though we clearly have more farther to go on the other side. Now, the leadership contest is being done in an interesting way. It used to be that the caucus and parliament chose the leader, and that's all there was to it. They would meet behind closed doors, and they would probably argue, and maybe through fists, I don't know. But they would decide who the leader was going to be. But times have changed. The party leadership wanted to democratize the selection of the leader, because ultimately the leader has to take the party to the next election. And so what they've done is they've come up with a formula that 40% of the total vote of for who will be the prime minister comes from caucus, the Labour Party MPs. The members of parliament. 40% comes from the membership of the Labour Party, ordinary people, and 20% comes from the five affiliated unions. And let's do that first, the unions. The way that they come up with their vote depends on how they want to do it. It has to be a democratic selection process one way or another. But in the case of at least some of the unions, they elect delegates to go to the national conference, I think it is, and they will be the ones who will vote on who they want to be leader of the Labour Party. And but others may put it to the membership. I don't really know how they're all going to do it. There's one union, the Service Workers Union, I think it is, that all of their members will be just treated like ordinary members. So they're not included in that 20%. Now, the membership thing was anybody who was a paid financial member by midnight on the day that the leader announced his resignation. Now, supposedly, some people on the right have joined the Labour Party just so they could vote for the weakest possible candidate as leader. But the problem with that is, number one, I'm skeptical that there was any huge number of people that actually did that, because, first of all, you've got to pay money, but also because they would have to have some sort of foresight as to, or lucky guess, as to who's the weakest of the candidates. Because at that time, remember, there were no announced candidates. There were only speculative candidates, Grant Robertson and David Cunliffe and possibly Shane Jones, but a couple of others as well. So they would have to hope that the weakest candidate actually was one of the ones who came forward. Secondly, they would have to hope that enough other people would go along with their views to make that person the winner. And that's just not likely. Of those three candidates, I don't know which, I'll come back to that in a second. So I'm not really sure that that's true, but I do think that just to play it safe, that they should probably change the rules to say anybody who's a financial member by midnight of the day before the leader resigns. It will cut out some last-minute people, I know, but I think that that's the fairest way to do it to make sure that nobody can try to game the system when there's a sudden announcement like that. In American terms, it's a bit like when people vote in the opposite party's primaries in order to try to get a weak candidate nominated so that their candidate will have an easier time of it. I know that's certainly happened in the past. I know that my own parents voted they were Republicans and they voted in the Democratic primary so that they could vote for a candidate for our county sheriff in order to take on the Republican candidate who was corrupt as and ended up going to prison for corruption. But it was the only way to defeat him because it was impossible to defeat him in the Republican primary. So I'm just going to have a sip of my coffee. Ah, that's better. Soothes the vocal cords. So that's a different instance, but it's the same sort of principle where you kind of wade into the other party's territory in order to kind of muck around, although in that case it was basically to get at the Republicans rather than make things worse for the Democrats. But anyway, the thing is that I have rejoined the Labour Party. My financial contributions had lapsed, but I'm friends with a local politician by the name of Richard Hills, who's on the Kaipatike local board in the Auckland Council area. And he's also probably a rising star in the party. He is a rising star in the party. He's 26 or 27, I think. 26, maybe. I've forgotten how old he is exactly. 26, I think. Anyway, he's young. And along with a handful of others, I think he's really the future of the party. And so he's sort of, we get together every couple of months or so for a coffee and chat. And he's been bugging me to re-up. So I did. And so I got my Labour Party membership card in the mail just the other day. And it turned out it was the exact same day that David Scheer resigned. And I didn't know that because I'd been out running errands. And I was looking at my card and I thought, oh, I'll take a picture of that and post it on Twitter. So I went and took a picture of it and then signed into Twitter. And all these people are talking about Scheer having resigned. I'm like, what? Timing is everything, right? But because I'm a member, I get to vote for the next leader of the Labour Party. And I will, of course. I got an email today from the general secretary of the party that the ballot papers are in the mail and they're already winging their way to me. Pardon me, I'm going to pause for a second so I can cough. That's better. I also had a sip of coffee while I was away. Not that you'd know that, of course. But anyway, so the ballot papers are in the mail, and they're also hosting a series of meetings around the country so that Labour Party members can meet the candidates. And there was a partial list that was in the email, and there's nothing here in the North Shore part of Auckland where we live. The closest one, I think, is in an area called Western Springs. But I'll probably wait and see what the complete list is to see which one I'm going to go to if I can. And I'll just have to see. Because at this point, I don't know if I can go. I just want to go, partly because I can blog about it. But also because I'm curious to see these people in action. I have not met any of those three candidates for leader. I'm just trying to think if they've ever even been at an event. Well, a party launch probably. A campaign launch, maybe when was the last one I went to now that I think about it? It's 2005. So no, I don't think any of them were there. Shane Jones might have been. I don't really remember, to be honest. But I've never met any of them in person. And that could be interesting in itself, I suppose. And the other thing about this is that all three of them are younger than me. I'm slowly getting used to this idea because President Obama is younger than me as well. And it's taking a little adjustment to, everybody gets to that point sooner or later, right? I mean, hopefully we do, where presidents and prime ministers and things start to be younger than us. But it's when it happens, it's one of those things I'm like, ooh, maybe it's true for other people where it just sort of happens and they're suddenly surprised or something. I don't know. But anyway, that is the case. They are all three younger than me. And there's been interesting reactions all over the traps. There are people who are ardent, passionate supporters of all three of them. And there are also people who are ardent, passionate opponents of all three of them. And the things that they like and dislike about them tend to have to do with where they are on the political spectrum. David Cunliffe probably appeals more to the left wing of the party, Grant Robertson to the center and left, and Shane Jones to the right. And that's just my observation. I don't think I'm wrong, by the way, but that's my observation. And but what I don't particularly care for is the assistance, shall we say, that we're getting from our friends on the right, who have all kinds of opinions about the various candidates and who would be better and all that sort of stuff. And I'm thinking, well, that's very nice of you to say, but I don't remember asking your opinion. Some of them are being really disingenuous, including John Key, who's the leader of the National Party as well as Prime Minister. He's been saying all kinds of things that are in his own political interests, and he's been just taken at face value. Nobody's challenging him on that. He keeps talking about how the Labour caucus is deeply divided, or the party actually is deeply divided. But it's not like he would know because he's not in this party. And I'm very skeptical about anything he says about this contest because it's in his best interests to trash the party and tear them down and make them seem incompetent. He once said something like, if they can't manage their own party, what makes them think that people will trust them to run the country or something like that? Well, of course he would say that. And he also said that if David Cunliffe is the leader, that it will be an ultra-left ticket or whatever, and pushing the far left and all that. Well, it's in his interests to say that because he's trying to win over the voters in the middle who are not necessarily Labour or National but can be won by either side and frequently are won by either side. He doesn't need to convince his own supporters, of course, and he can't support the can't win over the left wing of Labour. And I don't know. It's unfortunate that he has chosen to try so hard to convince people that he's right, and to tried so hard to convince people that he's some sort of oracle on all matters political when he's clearly not. He's had a really rough time of it lately in Parliament because he's gotten a lot of opposition to the stuff that he's been trying to do. He pushed through this bill for the Government Communications Security Bureau, GCSB, which creates an unprecedented level of spying on ordinary New Zealanders. He denies it. He denied it right up until the bill was passed by one vote. But it does. All of the experts agree that that particular bill is a wholesale assault on the privacy of New Zealanders. And a lot of this came about because the scandals with the NSA in the U.S., but a lot of it is just homegrown stuff where New Zealanders don't like being snooped on, and John Key wants to allow the government to do that. And a lot of what this has to do with is the raid on Kim.com's compound. They basically did it with U.S. authorities and under the direction of the FBI and apparently the NSA. But it was all illegal what they did. And so basically what they're trying to do is change the law to make what was illegal legal. And the result has been has been really messy. There have been a large number of people who have criticized the bill, saying it needs to be changed or thrown out and start over. And without exception, everyone who opposed it, John Key said they didn't know what they were talking about and they were wrong, even though in many cases it was their jobs to know. Human Rights Commission had a submission against it, and he actually threatened them. He said, well, if they want to continue government funding, they shouldn't criticize the government. And that's a dangerous precedent. And the Law Society, which represents lawyers and also advocates on laws, opposed the bill, and he said that they didn't understand the law. Well, hello, they're lawyers. They probably understand more than you do as an investment banker. Or high-stakes gamblers, I like to call them. If your fallback position whenever you get people opposing you is to say that your opponents don't know what they're talking about and they're stupid, well, you probably are not on very strong ground. And the way they got it through is there's a guy named Peter Dunn who's a one-person party the party's called United Future, but he's the only one in it. And the only reason he's in Parliament is because he won his electorate. But whether he will this time or not, who knows? Probably not. If he doesn't retire, he probably will be defeated. And he initially opposed the bill, but he changed his position after discussions in quote marks, with the government. And he said that they had it was a situation with a willing seller and a willing buyer. Well, apparently what was bought and sold was an overseas diplomatic posting. And apparently what's going to happen is that the national government will appoint him to some overseas ambassadorship somewhere. Well, obviously it's overseas. It wouldn't be here. To an ambassadorship or something somewhere, or a high commission or whatever. And they'll be rid of him that way. And so he'll get something out of it, because his parliamentary career is just about over anyway. And so he basically sold his soul for 30 pieces of silver, but in this case it was just a overseas posting. So it was legal but corrupt, this whole process, and it certainly was tainted. And now there's a companion bill called TICS, Telecommunications Interceptor something, I don't know. I forgot what it stands for, TICS. And the experts are saying it's even worse than the other one because, among other things, it requires all service providers in New Zealand to offer a back door for spying by the government. And experts are warning that if this goes through, it will destroy the IT industry in New Zealand, which was the great hope to get away from dairying and, well, the primary sector in general, but the dairy sector in particular. And that's been in the news because there was a report of a botulism contamination of milk powder, I think it was. And it was traced to a plant in the Waikato, which where a pipe wasn't cleaned properly. And of course, it was probably a minimum wage employee anyway. And so then, you know, you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. You know that old saying? Well, you know, if you don't pay people well, they're not going to be as engaged as they probably should be. And but since then, Fonterra, which is our dairy conglomerate, says that they've had independent tests done by several different outfits, all of which have found no traces of botulism in the powder, and it was all a big scare about nothing. Well, they've had continuing problems with tainted products that have been sold in China. And since the primary sector in general and dairying in particular is our biggest foreign earner, this is a major concern. And the fact that New Zealand is so heavily dependent on this, on the dairy sector in particular. I mean, New Zealand accounts for something like 30 to 40% of all of the dairy products sold in the world, butter in particular. So, you know, we need to diversify our economy. And when you have people who are pandering to their base, because the farming sector is the base of the National Party, instead of thinking for the good of all New Zealanders, for the future of all New Zealanders, it's definitely a worry. Which brings us back to the labor selection process, because if they don't pick the right guy, then the National and John Key will get back in again, which would be a small disaster. It's a terrible government. It really is terrible. So, which is a whole topic in itself. So those are the big things that have been going on in New Zealand in recent weeks. I'm not going to have links to all of that in the show notes, partly because none of that is new news. All of it is fairly old, although the leadership thing is still going on. You can follow my blog, amrins.blogspot.com, if you want to see about the labor leadership business or whatever, because I am going to be blogging about that extensively. And in future episodes, I may link back to specific things. Actually, I should do a tag just for those. Maybe I will. Anyway, moving on. Now, as I said, we've been up to quite a lot since I last podcasted. One of the big things that happened was that we had laminate flooring put down in what I call the public areas of the house, basically the lounge, dining room, kitchen, which is all open plan, and the hallways that connect it and the bathroom and the bedrooms and all that, but not the bedrooms. The bedrooms are all carpeted still. And that meant, among other things, that we had to remove all of the furniture, obviously. Well, maybe not obviously, but we did. So the carpets could come up and then the flooring laid down. Now, this was started the end of July, actually, and it was supposed to take about 4 days, we figured, for maybe 5 days, we figured. And the guy was starting on a Wednesday. However, we were going away that weekend for Nigel's mom's birthday, and so he was only going to come Wednesday and Thursday. Well, he came Wednesday. He had hurt his back, apparently. You know, not our fault, not his fault. It just happened. So he wasn't able to do a whole lot the first day, and he came back the next day and did a bit more. Didn't do a whole day again because he had to go to the physiotherapist. And then he came again the following week, I think it was Tuesday, if I remember correctly, and carried on. And then it took another week. It took the better part of 3 entire weeks for him to do this job. And he wasn't exactly the cream of the crop, shall we say. He probably did about as well as we would have done if we attempted to do it ourselves. Probably a bit better than that, actually, because we had no idea what we were doing. But his fitting was not very good. He didn't take enough care with the things. The laminate flooring is artificially made. It's made to look like wood. The surface on it is melamine, which is the same stuff that's on desktops. And it is very scratch resistant and stain resistant. But it can chip, especially on the edges. And anybody who's ever had a desk probably knows that how easy it is to do that. If you hit it, you don't even have to try too hard to hit it right to do that. And so some of the places where the joins were, there were chips. And then he went, when he was filling it, near the walls, he often did really messy cuts and things like that. Well, and then he put the skirtings on the molding around the floor, because these laminate systems are called floating floors. They lock together and they sit on top of a foil and foam underlay, which also it makes the floor softer. It absorbs sound, and it also makes the place warmer than it otherwise would be if it was just a hard floor. And but that means you have to leave about 10 mils, I think it is, around the perimeter of the room so that the floor has got room to expand and contract. And so you can do this one of two ways. You can either remove all the skirtings or floor moldings, as they're sometimes called in America anyway, and then replace them afterwards, which is a big job in a house like this where they're all down, obviously. Or you can lay them up to there, near there, and then put other molding like a quarter round or something to cover the gap, which is what we decided to do. Now, we didn't know if we wanted to stain them. Oh, he was originally going to look at some moldings that were like $25 for 3 meters or something like that. And we're thinking, what? So we went and found what we wanted, just pine stuff, which was, I think it was something like $6 for a 3 meter length, or it wasn't even that much. I think it was about a dollar something a meter. So it was much less expensive. But we didn't know if we wanted painted or stained. And so I just urethaned them all, with, you know, just spray urethane. And then he installed them, and now, of course, we've decided we want to paint them, but that's another issue. That's fine. But he didn't have a drop saw or a miter saw or anything like that. He was cutting them with a handheld device, kind of like a Dremel or, I don't know, but just it's sort of like an electric screwdriver that's got attachments. And so some of the miter cuts were really bad. And the worst thing was that when he was doing, it was supposed to be the last day, and he was putting these metal treads. We have 3 steps down from the garage to get into the house. And he's putting these metal treads on the edges, and which help keep you from slipping, for one thing. And he was working on the last one, and he apparently cut it wrong. Nigel heard him swear. I didn't. Nigel was home. I didn't hear him swear. And he said he'd have to come back the next day. And he came back, and he filled around, did stuff, and then he left. And then I went and looked at what he'd done. He put on 2 entirely different pieces of metal. There's a join. One part is too short, and then the gap is filled with, maybe 12, 15 centimeters of this other entirely different color metal. And so I said to Nigel afterwards, I said, even if I had noticed that while he was here, I just would have let him go because I wanted him out. I was so over this whole project by that point. And I said, we'll just fix it later. And since then, we have been fixing. We've got putty stuff to fill some of the gaps, and we've also got caulk to fill other areas, and basically we're going to sort it out ourselves. Oh, and Nigel also got the proper stuff to fix laminate flooring as well. It's a very expensive thing, but there are some areas where we need need a different kind of finish, and that will enable us to do it, and also to match the color perfectly. So that was our big ordeal, and it took about another week or so before we finally got the television back up and running again. And but now we've also bought new mats for the floor. We had one in the lounge before, but we put a new one down, and also a couple runners in the hallways because it's sort of a T-shaped hallway. And it totally changed the look of the place, and I really like it now. It's not that I disliked it before, but now I especially like it. I just think it looks really nice and homey and classic. Not classic. What's what I'm looking for? Classy. And so that was good. It was a long time getting there. The whole process, start to finish, was about a month. And it got to be really quite trying at the end. But it was also really noisy all that time. And he was in the house, obviously. And so I obviously didn't feel I could record at all during that time. And then we had a lot of family things going on. We had that weekend away. We had everybody here one weekend. Nigel's mom stayed with us, not this past week, but the week before. And so we've had all this stuff going on, and I just haven't had a chance to be by myself enough to even collect my thoughts to record, let alone to actually sit down and record. So that's what I've been up to, what we've been up to for the past several weeks, I guess. Yeah, probably more than that now. There's all sorts of other stuff that we've been up to since the last episode, and quite frankly, I'm not really sure what everything was, and I'm not even sure it's all that interesting. I mean, if you listen to Auntie Vera, he'll talk about going grocery shopping or whatever and saying, oh, yes, this is my exciting life. Well, it's not all that different for us either. I mean, most of the things that I do on a given day aren't terribly interesting, and they're not the sort of thing that would make good podcast content. So that's partly why I don't talk about things like that all that often. But it has been a busy time. Now, coming up on tomorrow, actually, the Smart Box comes home. Longtime listeners may recall that when we were going to put our house on the market, this was a year ago in January, I guess. Yes, it was January of 2012. We hired this thing called Smart Box, and there's similar things in the U.S. I don't know what they're called, but they basically bring this big moving trailer to you, a large moving trailer. And inside that is a wooden box, kind of a crate, and more like a shed, I suppose, in some ways. And you fill it up with all your stuff, and then they take it away and they store it in a warehouse for you. And then when you're ready, you ring them up, they bring it back. And so that stuff has been in storage since January of 2012, which would be fine if we had organized it that way. But at the time, we were decluttering the house to put it on the market. And so there's all kinds of stuff in there that is not junk or not stuff that we'd want to store away, but it's stuff that we actually like need. And like our Kenwood mixer for the kitchen, for instance. And what else is in there? All of my old family recipes I packed away and put in storage. And some of my old files for work that I didn't need at the time, I haven't had any access to now for over a year. Not important stuff. They're like reference copies of publications I've worked on and stuff. So it's nothing urgent or important even necessarily, but it's just the fact that I can't access them. All of our DVDs are packed away, which again isn't a big drama because we didn't actually watch them very often anyway, and stuff like that. So the Smart Box is coming home tomorrow. We've temporarily, we normally store our little camper in the garage, and that's over at Nigel's sister's house. And I've cleared out the garage as best I can, and we're just going to bring it all in, stack it all up, except for the things that we know are going into the house right away. And then I'm going to take about a week to go through all of the boxes. And I told Nigel that I'm just going to make largely executive decisions about stuff that we no longer need. For instance, we had dozens of coffee mugs, which we don't even use anymore. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to pack them up. And Nigel's mom volunteers at an op shop, which is, I forget what you call it in America. It's you know, like a charity shop where they sell used stuff. I don't know what it's, I can't think of what it's called in America. Thrift store, I think. Yeah, so I'll give them to her to sell at that store. And, or maybe I'll even take some locally, because I'm hoping there'll be that much. And I'm also planning on taking stuff up to the tip, the dump as well down the road. But that's a little further along. So the goal is that, and not just wants to rent a place, another storage thing right away and take stuff there. He says, oh, because we can go visit it. I reminded him that doesn't get around the fact that all of the stuff was packed just to get it out of the house, and we've got important stuff mixed in with unimportant stuff. And I said, and by the way, I don't think we should be paying to store stuff. If we don't have room for it, why don't we just get rid of it? And so that's what my goal is. I don't know that that's actually going to work because houses are smaller than they used to be and they don't have the storage space that they used to have. So there may be some stuff that we want to keep for whatever reason, and the only solution will be to store it. We actually think we will get a storage unit ultimately to keep the camper in, and it'll have enough room in it because the camper is quite small. It's basically, I don't know if I've talked about it before, but it's called a teardrop camper. It's basically a bed on wheels. Actually, I should do a video or something about just that. But anyway, It's small enough that inside a storage unit would have plenty of room to store boxes if that's what we choose to do. But before that, I'm determined we're going to get rid of stuff. And that's going to be not this coming week, because it's my work project this coming week. It'll be the week after where I'm going to be doing that. Although I'm going to do some this weekend because it arrives at 2 p.m. tomorrow. I'm going to have Nigel help me unload it. And hopefully I'll get through some stuff perhaps tomorrow and Sunday. And then I'll stop basically for the week. And carry on the following week, but hopefully this is good. Hopefully this will go well and not kill me. It could happen. So that's the big thing that's coming up. And in the midst of that, I have all sorts of other reorganization going on. I mean, we've redone the lounge, dining, kitchen area, the floors anyway, and also some other redecorating along with that. And we still plan on doing the master bedroom. Redecorating the master bedroom, not redoing it. But ultimately, we there are bigger projects we'd like to do, like, well, I don't know, redo the ensuite, which is often called a master bath in America. So, you know, these things, and I've talked about this before, about how there are things we want to do to make this house more what we want it to be, since we weren't able to move on. And, you know, we'll just, I suppose those will become topics for future episodes as time goes on. But that is it for today. That's it for this week. That's it for the past 2 months. I need to oil my chair, obviously. And Sonny didn't bark even once. Well, that's got to be some kind of a record. But that is it for today and for this week. I will talk to you sooner than I have since last time or whatever. Have a great weekend, everybody. Bye. You can comment on this or any episode of the Amryns Podcast at amrynspodcast.com, where you can also leave a voice message. You can send me an audio message through Audioboo or Skype, where my username is Amryns, and you can email me, with or without a voice message, at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrynspodcast.com. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.